We are talking today with Ben Sherman. He is author of the book Medic, The Story of a Conscientious Objector in the Vietnam War. Ben, thanks for coming in today.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Could you tell us what was the motivation in writing your book Medic?
Well, I was quiet about the war for a long time. 10 years after I got home, I got back in 70, and it's around 81, right after the inauguration of Reagan, I think the hostages were released from Iran. They'd been captured a long time, and there'd been a lot in the news about them, and they came home and got a great ticker tape parade down Avenue in New York, and it just angered me. And I was writing for a local newspaper where I lived in Georgetown, Texas at the time. I was what they call a stringer. I was just writing editorials when the editor was tired. And she asked me to write an editorial on the very day that this happened, but she didn't ask me to write about that. In fact, nobody was really paying much attention. But I was a vet, and I had done a little bit of work with some veterans down in Austin, and most of them were in alcohol rehab, and I was a medic in the service, and I was doing some work down there sort of extending my medic thing. And the Iran hostages, I was just angry. I was just totally insulted by our country throwing a parade for people who, in my, I feel differently about it now, but at the time, I felt like these were people who were going to Iran for business. They were there for financial reasons. The State Department had warned them against going to a hostile area. They got captured. They got abused. They got tortured, whatever. But I didn't see them as American heroes that deserved a ticker tape parade. I saw them as just business people who had left their families and to make money. And here I was drafted and sent to Vietnam, and I got no parade. And so I wrote this article, Where's My Parade? And it was scathing. It was ugly. It was just, it was a rant. It was the worst possible rant. Very similar to what a lot of people typically think of Vietnam veterans as, these terrible, angry people running around the forest. Well, here came this rant, and I've looked at it since, and just, I don't want anybody ever to read it again. But the interesting thing, at that time in history, and coming right off the inauguration and all that, the response in my small town was that our editor got people coming by with letters and actually delivering them in person to be sure they got in the paper the next Sunday. And by Friday of that week, she'd had over 100 letters. She said it was the most she'd ever had responding to an editorial page thing. And they were mostly favorable. They were mostly saying, where's my parade? Why have we dissed these Vietnam veterans so much? So because of that experience, and it was kind of humorous because I call the editor, my nickname for her, for Linda, is Scoop, because she called me Thursday morning after her paper came out on Wednesday with my editorial in it. She called me Thursday morning and said, have you seen the national news? And I said, no. She says, well, there are veterans all over the nation are writing articles and writing letters, and they've got all these things about the mad Vietnam veterans and where's my parade? And she says, so we scooped the national news with our little hometown bi-weekly newspaper, you know. So we laughed about that, and I call her Scoop. But that led to, because of the response and because of a lot of conversations, that was the first time I ever talked about Vietnam. And that led to actually sitting down and writing my first draft and going through old notes I'd had. It was, for me, mostly therapy. It was mostly seeing this ad and then being a little embarrassed about it. I mean, I lived in this tiny town, 11,000 people, and everybody who would talk to me in the store or whatever, and I saw your article, and gee, I didn't even know you were a Vietnam vet, and they'd get in this whole conversation thing, and kind of just embarrassed me. And I thought, gee, Ben, if you're that angry, you know, you probably need to figure out where that anger is coming from and how has that affected other things in your life. So I just started writing and wrote for, you know, 3 or 4 months, and whenever I had a chance, I just wrote. That was before I was married. I was single, and I had time, so I did a lot of writing. And then I just left it alone, didn't even bring it out for another 10 years. But I got it kind of all out of me and thought, okay, then that's great. That's, therapy's done. Didn't have to pay anybody for it. And then about 10 years later, about 1990, 91, I pulled out all these papers, and at the time, when I had written it the first time, I didn't have a computer. This was before PCs. So all of it was done on a Lexitron word processor, and I had only the manuscript. I didn't have any electronic backup. because all of the technology had changed. In the meantime, I learned how to use a computer and did everything on word processor. So I had to literally retype 450 pages and start back into this thing. And I've got stacks and stacks of papers at home. That's how it started.
So part of the story itself is your experiences in Vietnam as a medic. How did you get pulled into Vietnam?
Well, I was drafted. My draft board was Sacramento, and I had applied to be a conscientious objector with my draft board, and they denied me, and I appealed the denial, and they voted against me, and so I got drafted. And when I was in the service, I explained to my basic training captain that I was a conscientious objector, that I wasn't going to shoot anybody. And he said, well, you know, this is just basic training. You just, all you have to do is carry around an unloaded weapon, and if that's okay with you, then you won't cause any fuss. And when you get out of basic training, you'll get a school. You'll get what's in the military called an MOS, military occupational status. And then, you know, if you get truck driver or something, you'll be fine, or clerk or cook or something. And I said, okay, great. So then, of course, at the end of that 10-week basic training here at Fort Lewis, I got infantry, of course. That's the way it works. So I went to my infantry captain the first day I was there and said, here, we have this problem. And he was actually a pretty cool guy. He said, you know, you make sense here, and there's really nothing I can do about it. I can't change your status. I'm not the Pentagon. And bummer that you got drafted, but our options are very few. But I can see your point. I don't want you being in my platoon carrying a weapon. If you're out there trying to decide whether or not you're going to shoot somebody, that's not the kind of guy I want in front of me with my life in his hands. And I would much rather you were a medic or a radio operator or a clerk or something. So let's just see what we can do. And so he sort of fumed about it a little bit and talked to a couple of people about it and came back and said, you know, there's just nothing. And the commanding officer said, the only thing that will get him out of training as an infantryman is to refuse an order, and then he goes to jail. So when he told me that, I said, okay, so no options. And then I was out on the pistol range about my second week of training and was looking at a target, right, you know, like 20 feet in front of me that looked like my cousin Ernie. And I just said, I don't really have a cousin Ernie. But I said, all right, that's it. And I just put the pistol down in front of me on the little pedestal and stepped back and said, not doing it. The captain came out to the training area and all the training stopped and all the people went over to one side, and the sergeant was threatening me, and the captain gave me an order three times and added witnesses each time. And finally the MPs came and took me and dragged me off to jail, and I stayed in what's called a holdover barracks. They call it that because they don't want to call it a jail, but it has bars on the doors and the windows, and you don't go out at night. Fortunately, because the captain was sort of on my side, he let me work in the orderly room for him as a clerk typist, and I learned to type and spent my time, my couple months there at Fort Lewis, that could have been really miserable. I spent it working every day for, you know, 12, 14 hours a day because I didn't want to go over to the barracks and be with all the sort of the weird folks that were living over there for all sorts of reasons. They were in this holdover barracks. And then my orders came through from the Pentagon and granted me status as a conscientious objector. I mean, it's very rare to get that when you're in the service. I mean, when you're already in, it's very rare. But I think partly the letter that my captain sent along with it, and that I was willing to work and I was willing to go to Vietnam, and I was being a good clerk typist and behaving myself and not really being a protester or anything, I think he helped me. But I got orders and I went to Fort Sam Houston. I took training for 10 weeks there as a medic, field medic, and then found myself on a plane going over to Vietnam about 2 months after my cycle had already moved over there. So that's how that happened.
And was it in your training that you discovered you actually excelled at medic type?
Oh, yeah, actually, you know, I broke the record at Fort Sam Houston. It's kind of a funny story. They have these points that they give, and the points are tests, you know, like written tests that you take and field tests that you take and then physical training. And I wasn't the top of my class in physical training. I mean, I was in good shape. I'd played soccer in college and stuff. I was in great shape, but I was good enough, but I maxed every test. I mean, I got hundreds on all my written tests and hundreds on all my field tests. And I broke a record that had been at Fort Sam Houston since, I think they said 1955 or 54 or something like that. I have a letter somewhere from my commanding officer that said, congratulations, you're graduating with honors, you've broken a long-standing record, yada, yada. They made a big deal about it at my graduation. And then I was in Vietnam, and a guy joined our company, a guy named Gordon, who had actually been in the holdover barracks back at Fort Lewis. And he got orders 2 weeks after I did, and I didn't know he was even a medic. And he'd gone through the cycle 2 weeks after I had at Fort Sam Houston. I never saw him because he was in another part of the camp. But I ran into him just coincidentally in Vietnam. And he said, oh, yeah, I heard that you broke the record. I said, yeah, I was all proud. And yeah, I did. Ha, ha, ha. He says, and I said, well, how'd you find out? He said, well, they said it at my graduation because a guy in my cycle broke your record. And I went, oh, jeez. And so, you know, my record lasted for 2 weeks after one I broke that had been around for 20 years. Anyway, that was kind of a funny story about old Gordon. I said, well, thanks a lot. You could have gone all day without telling me that. But yeah, I was a good medic. I mean, I knew my stuff, and I knew that for my survival, the sergeants in our platoon told us, you'll do these things that you're taught because they're routine. We're going to practice them so many times that you don't even have to think about it, because when the bombs and the bullets start flying, you're going to be just working off of memory and just sort of like rote. You're just going to go to this because you've done it so many times. And he was right about that. He was truly right about that. Last thing he said to us was, you'll do everything you've been trained with tears in your eyes and your heart and your throat. And boy, was he right. I mean, I didn't even think about the actual movement of my hands. It just came to me that there was a need to work rapidly and get it done because there were a lot of casualties and we needed to get them ready to get into a helicopter and get out of there. So they gave us pretty good training there.
And that was something you put to use almost in the first seconds of your arrival in Vietnam. Is that right?
Yeah, actually, I was on a commercial airline, and when we landed at Binh Hoa, we were under attack, and this big, huge jumbo jet, like, slid sideways. It was really scary, because it was a huge jet, and it did what you would do in your little car, you know, if you're trying to avoid an accident, you know, you slide, sort of. I mean, they lost control of this jet, and as soon as it hit the tarmac, they threw the brakes on harder than I'd ever experienced, and the plane actually slid on a kind of like a four-wheel slide going to the right. And as soon as they got the stairs down, a guy came running and said, incoming, and we were under attack. And I got to an old sergeant, and I ran across the tarmac, and I got to a bunker, and he'd been there before. He'd been to Vietnam before, so I sort of followed this guy because he knew what he was doing. And as soon as I got in the bunker, somebody had hit their head, and I was helping a guy with a... I mean, I think he bumped his head coming into the bunker. He wasn't wounded by enemy fire, but... So immediately, I didn't even have a bag. I didn't have any supplies. There was another medic there that was handing me stuff out of his bag. He was a guy who was actually going out. He was leaving country as I was coming in, or at least I thought he was. And so he was handing me bandages and stuff. So yeah, I was literally on the ground 30 seconds. It was already using what I'd been taught and not even thinking about it, not considering whether or not I was doing it right or anything, just helping a guy with a bumped head. You know, facial wounds bleed really a lot, so he didn't have a very bad wound, but he bumped his... He was a tall guy. He's like 6'6", and he hit his head coming into the bunker and just opened his forehead up. And so, of course, his whole face is full of blood, and it looks terrible. It was nothing. It was just a little scratch, but it looked really a lot worse than it was. But, yeah, it was pretty interesting that I hadn't even signed in yet and didn't have any supplies, just was in my khakis with my orders on my lap, you know, and hear the plane were under attack when we got there.
So you went from there to your first duty was working on a ship, is that right?
I was assigned to a base camp called Dong Tam, and my first duty was in the morgue. This clerk said, all medics get the morgue, and it's the way we... His term here, it's the way we pop your cherry. It was the idea that they didn't want any medics out in the field that were going to get crazy if they saw dead people. So I spent 3 days putting bodies in rubberized plastic bags. That was my first job. And then I was assigned to a medical company. Something changed after the Tet Offensive in the Mekong Delta, where the guerrillas and stuff were. They had found that medics and first lieutenants and radio operators seemed to be getting shot by snipers more than anything else. And it's a real sniper war in a guerrilla area. It detonated, what's it called, command detonated mines, meaning somebody's watching you coming down the trail and they actually hit the trigger and blow you away. Or snipers who can pick out who they want to shoot in a platoon. And medics were the number one to get shot. And the purpose of that in a guerrilla warfare is just to demoralize the troops. They can't shoot all of you, so they got to pick somebody. And they want to pick the one that has the most chance of demoralization. And that would be if they could find a lieutenant. And, of course, the lieutenants aren't always obviously the lieutenant because they don't wear their silver rank on their collar. They wear blacks for that purpose. So they might be just one of the platoon. But medics are pretty obvious. Medics don't carry a whole lot of ammunition. And a lot of us didn't have weapons. And we're carrying a very noticeable medic bag. It doesn't have a big red cross on it, but it looks different than the rest of them. So here they were losing all these medics. And because of the demoralization to a troop who'd gotten to know their medic, and the medic kind of becomes mom and doctor, and it's the person who changes socks and has all the salt pills and is there to save your life if you get injured. And so you get attached sort of to your medic. Well, by the time I got to Vietnam in 69, they had just changed it that they put the field medics in this company kind of as an experiment, and they assigned them out to the platoons in pairs, but they exchanged the pairs, so no two medics stayed with the same platoon. They would only go on one mission, and then it would rotate. And that also put the medics not in the field all the time. My company had a rotation of, we worked in a, we didn't call it a MASH unit, but I think the listeners would understand it best by a MASH unit, a mobile hospital with a surgery unit and a ward. And that was on a ship called the Nueces, a Navy ship that was sailing up and down the Mekong River, big troop carrier ship. And then the second thing was medevacs, and we would be assigned to the hospital or then to medevacs, or then the third thing was the field. So we moved those three things and were never attached to one medevac unit or one field unit. We rotated in and out. And it was explained to me that this is in an attempt, just because the Viet Cong knew who was who. I mean, they knew everything that was going on around us, that this was an attempt to save the lives of medics so that they wouldn't be targeted as the morale killer if you get the medic, because this was the medic was always new to each platoon. I don't know how well that worked, but that was the reason why I had three jobs instead of just being in the field all the time, why they put me in that kind of a situation. As I understand it from talking to other medics, that only was happening in Dong Tab, and it was only happening in one medical company. Another guy explained to me that I kind of got it wrong. He said, no, that was actually because so many medics had been killed that they just made up this whole company of medics so that they could keep throwing them out there, keep supplying them. I don't like that story. I like my story better.
I'm wondering if we could cover the stay that you did have in the morgue, because that is a fairly intriguing story, and it seemed like it was really the beginning of your experience there in Vietnam.
Well, I don't want to give the book away, but I will say that the morgue duty is, the morgue is run by the quartermaster. The quartermaster is the supply sergeant or the supply company. So they're the ones who take care of blankets and toilet paper and medical supplies and typing paper and all the stuff that the Army needs. I think with the exception of food and ammunition, everything else that supports the troop is handled somehow by the quartermaster. Well, it was interesting to me that the morgue was part of supply, that when a person dies, they now become something that needs to be shipped somewhere, rather than a live human fighting soldier. Now they are so much property that the Army needs to, in essence, get rid of. They're part of the waste product of the military effort. They're no good to anybody anymore. They need to be dispatched. Now that may be an awful way to look at it, and I apologize to people who have lost loved ones. I don't want to diss them at all. In fact, my reaction to that was horror and disbelief that the quartermaster, I mean, I'm one of the medical corps or a chaplain, you know, to be taking care of dead bodies. I want the quartermaster doing that. That's the guy that handed out toilet paper. But no disrespect intended at all. When I got into the morgue, my few days that I was there, there were two tall, lanky medics who were working there, and they didn't say much, and it was hot, humid. It was a tent. I mean, it had wood sides on it with sandbags around the sides, but it was a tent. It was canvas, and the sun was beating down on it, and inside you had the smell of disinfectants and the other smells that go with dead bodies that come with the body as they come in, and that includes everything from human waste to just the dank of the swamps and the dirty socks and the sweat and the everything. And so it wasn't a very nice place as far as smell was concerned, and then all this disinfectant is trying to cut through it. That made it worse as far as I was concerned. But they had the tables, and they were preparing bodies for shipment, and the idea, I guess, behind this, or at least these two guys who were working in there when I got there, was that when this body got home, they didn't want some more hometown mortician opening up a mess. So they were very diligently cutting off uniforms that were soiled, putting on, they had a whole stack, there were shelves at the side of the tent with new fatigues in them, sort of by size, that came right over from supplies. So mostly fatigue shirts, but in a couple of cases, pants where there'd been a leg wound or something. We were taking the clothes, so we're stripping these guys, and we were literally putting on new underwear, new fatigue pants, fatigue shirts, counting out everything, their dog tags, their change in their pocket, or the bills, or whatever was in their pocket, lucky charms, pictures of people, just stuff that they had, into a bag, and we inventoried all of it and put a list in the bag so that someone at home would know, and we cleaned them. I mean, we mopped them up. We cleaned between their toes, between their fingers, behind their ears, wiped all of the mess off of them if they were bloody or dirty, and then reclothed them, and if there were wounds or whatever, we patched them so that they wouldn't leak more, and then put them in a bag and zipped them up, put the little paper bag between their legs, and zipped them up, zipped this thing up over their face. It was priestly work. I don't know how else to explain it. It was touching to me that this was going on in there. And then the bag went into a coffin, aluminum box. It was attached in four places, I think, and then sent out back to be in a unit in the back that was a generator was running and keeping it refrigerated to at least a degree so that the bodies wouldn't be too hot in the sun of the Vietnam afternoon. And then periodically, every other day or so, someone would come by with a truck and pick up all the coffins and take them down to the landing strip there and ship them home. And to go back to Benoit and be put in a big cargo plane and then shipped home with the scene of the coffins with the flags draped over and all. That all happened after we were finished. We didn't do any of that stuff. They did that at the debarkation station in Benoit. So that was kind of what was going on in the morgue. It was interesting work and set the tone for the whole war for me. And I would say of all of the images that I had in the war, and I was really scared a lot of times and saw stuff I didn't want to see, but I think of all the images, I think those first 3 days in the morgue are probably the one, seeing each face and seeing people who look just like me and just studying them as we were cleaning them up, I would see stuff. I'd see a scar on a guy's forearm and think, I wonder, did he break his arm? Or is that a sports injury? Or... because to me, these were just people, and their faces, they looked like me. I mean, they were young. They had this look on their face like, oops, like what happened? It's interesting about the dead and about what they look like. I mean, it kind of gets you. They don't look different than you, so it makes you think this could be me very easily. Especially the age. I mean, they're so young. See a guy with straight teeth. I mean, much straighter than mine. I mean, perfect teeth. And I think, did this guy have braces? And how long did he wear them? And what did that cost his parents? And now what a waste. I don't know. Maybe I'm just weird that way, but I was personalizing each of these guys. I wrote notes and stuck them in the bags. At first it was just good luck and smooth sailing, see you in the world, you know, and I'd make little promises, like I'd look at somebody's dog tags and I'd say, I'll never forget this person's name. Of course, I forgot it in a day. I mean, I don't have that kind of memory, but I'll find this person. I'll find their hometown. I'll go visit their grave or something. I'd make myself promises like that. And I didn't keep any of them, but I made them because I was trying to do something to make it a person rather than a human loss, rather than just a piece of equipment that was being shipped somewhere. And I got to writing, like, notes to the parents at home or whatever. And, hi, I'm Private Sherman. I'm working in the morgue, and I'm very sorry for your loss, and I'd be interested to know about this person's life. I care about this person. I'm sure they're a wonderful person, and I'm sorry, you know, and stuff like that. And I'd fold it up and throw it in there, and I'd give them my APO address and tell them to write me and tell me. I don't know. I feel now like maybe that was an invasion. Maybe I was stepping over some intimacy line and that maybe I shouldn't have done that. I didn't get any replies, of course. Who knows if anyone ever saw the note. And then people tell me, oh, no, that's not an invasion. You know, that was a good thing to do, and somebody probably really cared on the other end. And I'm not sure how I feel about that. I feel like it's an intimate moment when someone goes to visit their hometown mortician and see this son that they sent off to war, and now they're there in a slab, and they open the bag up and see all their little private things, and then they find this note, and I'm not sure how I feel about that. But I did it. Didn't get any replies.
Your description in the book was one of the memories that came to me when recently we had a brouhaha in our local media from some photos taken by a local photographer of the caskets on a plane over in Iraq, and the White House had gotten on this photographer saying that was totally inappropriate for you to photograph this, yet there was a large uproar over that, mainly in support of the photograph and the photographer, because to me it showed people who were giving great care to fallen soldiers, and it just made me recall those passages from your book that reinforced that, yes, this is one of the more respectable parts of these wars we engage in, is these people that end up caring for our fallen soldiers.
Yeah, I remember that. You know, it's just too easy to pick on this administration and wonder why they do things. I thought they were probably doing that because they wanted to hide the fact that there were losses. Well, that's coming from my side, of course. Well, I asked the mother of a guy who's there now. She's actually a Vietnam veteran herself. She was a medic in Vietnam same time I was. And her son's there now. He was recruited as a 17-year-old in high school without her knowledge. And he went off when he was 18, and he's in Iraq now. And I said, how do you feel about this casket thing? And she said, why is this government or this administration of this government opposed to respecting the losses? And that was her response. I don't have an answer for that. To me, to see, it's just truth. There is loss. I mean, let's just take it, you know, everybody always, my draft board, everybody else, they always say, well, war is necessary in some cases. And if you start to argue about any particular war, they always draw back to Nazi Germany. You know, like, would you stand up in front of Hitler? I got in a lot of trouble with my draft board because they asked me that question. And I asked them, if you were a German during World War II, would you have been on the draft board? Oh, boy, they didn't like that at all. In fact, they really hated that. They didn't laugh. I thought it was a good joke, but they didn't laugh. But so I want to just reverse that. I want to say, okay, if this was World War II and if our boys were going off to fight Hitler, would you say that we can't show the coffins coming home? I don't think so. So the same argument that the hawk side would use to say that stopping Hitler and the Germans in World War II was a just war, was a just cause, the same mentality glorified, put crosses in Arlington. I mean, everything we could do to show the sacrifice that people made. So now why is it that not only do the peaceniks and the liberals think that the war in Iraq is wrong, is absolutely wrong, it was wrong in its conception, it's wrong today, and that every life that's lost there is another indication of how wrong it is. I mean, that's the peacenik liberal side. What about the hawk side? Why are the hawks saying, we don't want you to see the losses? We don't want you to even respect. And that we think crosses in a field are put there by people who disagree with the war, rather than assuming that they're put there by people who agree with the war and are honoring the people who have gone over there and sacrificed their lives. Now, why is it that they make that assumption? I don't have an answer for that, unless they know in their heart of hearts that it is wrong, they're wrong, and that they're going to do this anyway. They're going to do it because they have a whole other agenda. Or, in their heart of hearts, they really don't respect the losses. And for people to put us in harm's way who have never been in harm's way themselves, that would make sense to me, that the losses don't matter to them. That's what my conclusion is. Otherwise, they would glorify those losses and say these are heroes, and that these heroes should be honored in every way possible, rather than swept under the rug and acted like they don't exist.